The idea was simple, really. I envisioned a new album of works for piano inspired by American elements. The particular influences really didn't matter to me. A familiar musical idioms, historical events, people, places, literature, and so forth. Everything was fair game as far as I was concerned. I then approached several composers with this idea and let them know that I was interested in reaching a wide audiences, especially those that might not traditionally listen to classical piano music.
That is the concept that launched the CD American Vernacular, produced and performed by Nicholas Phillips, and we're going to find out how various composers responded to the idea of writing music based on American elements. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
The New York Times has called Nicholas Phillips an able and persuasive advocate of new music. He performs often in the U.S. and abroad. He's a professor at the UW-Eau Claire. His latest CD is American Vernacular. And he's at the piano ready to take us on an excursion in new American music.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Let's start with your title, American Vernacular. Vernacular, we think of ordinary speech, something that's not as formal.
Right.
Tell us what you had in mind with the project itself.
Right. I think that the term vernacular is so broad. I mean, it can apply to speech, it can apply to music, it can apply to art. And I think that giving composers that broad theme limited them in terms of having a theme and not having no theme, but also gave them a lot of directions to take.
This is, I guess, kind of almost a crass question, but how did you get composers to get on board without paying lots of money?
Well, right. That's always the difficulty. And the composers on this disc, some of them are dear friends of mine and former colleagues. You know, some of them were commissioned with money. Some of them wrote just because they believed in the project. And I've just been really fortunate and humbled to have composers, really great composers to work with.
Is it classical music?
I would say yes. But I would say that, you know, the need to define it as classical music is maybe not necessary. You know, these are all composers who are, you know, in the liner notes, I put the word classical in quotation marks. These are all composers who are, you know, trained in the sort of the Western art tradition. Although, as you'll see with some of the pieces I play today, these composers have a wide variety of musical heritages, you know, musicians that they listened to growing up, stylistic influences that they had growing up. And I think that, you know, the Time Out Chicago recently did a feature on this, and they called me a postmodern pianist. And I thought that was really a great title. I didn't solicit it, but I think that really sums up the album, because composers today do have this freedom to write in whatever style they're called to write in.
What about form?
I think form is important in almost all of these pieces. You know, I think that, for example, sometimes simple ABA form. Sometimes there's a piece called A Southern Prelude, which is sort of a free-form piece, but what keeps coming back are these motivic ideas that are very audibly recognizable to the listener.
When you put it together for the CD, is there an order to how you did it? Like the first piece that's on your collection, the Requiem for John Fahey, is that first for a reason?
Well, I'm playing that first today for you, but the CD order starts with Spectacular Vernaculars, which is a three-movement suite by Marc Olivieri. And it's a good question. It was really difficult to pick an order. And the way I approach the order, I think there is kind of a narrative quality to it, but as Norman mentioned, the idea of form, the three-movement pieces that I have serve as sort of pillars. So Spectacular Vernaculars is first. The three piano miniatures by Mohammed Fairouz are sort of a central portion of the disc. And then the final piece is a three-movement suite by David Rakowski called Hot Fingers.
Do you play this as a concert set, though? In other words, duplicating the sequence, the contents of the discs?
That's a good question. I have a recital coming up that'll be my 12th run of this program, and I have experimented with different orders, and I've never done the order that's on the CD. I think the CD order works really well, but it doesn't work as well in concert. You know, when you have considerations of an intermission, for example, you want to end with something and begin with something that's appropriate.
Well, take us into something. Can you set up a piece and play it for us? Tell us what we should be listening for.
Sure. So the first piece I'll play for you is by Luke Gullickson, who's a young Chicago-based composer. And it's called Back Porch Requiem for John Fahey. And one of the really neat things about this project was it introduced me to some music and some musicians that I didn't know before. John Fahey is one of those, a great guitarist. And John Fahey and also John Hurt were both guitarists who were very influential in Luke's musical upbringing.
John Hurt going back, what, to the 20s?
20s, yes. And so this idea of sort of, you know, steel string, Delta blues guitar playing. John Fahey actually wrote a piece called Requiem for John Hurt. And so Luke uses the two of them and sort of pays an homage in this way. And so in this piece, you'll hear a lot of wide use of the piano's range and a lot of dissonant harmonies, like these sort of biting sevenths and ninths. But then you'll also hear Luke try to emulate the guitar picking sound on the piano in passages like this. With these notes that sort of come in offbeat, very reminiscent of the style of John Fahey's playing.
Interesting. Not the first time that a piano has imitated a guitar. Of course, Isaac Albéniz comes to mind, and
right.
Granados, turn of the 20th century, and to some extent, even farther back in, you know, the 18th century.
Yeah, Scarlatti's harpsichord sonatas, for example, the flamenco rhythms and things. But yeah, this is definitely a new, I think, a sort of new take on that tradition.
And with the title Requiem, anything that kind of goes with that?
Well, I think, you know, he's paying homage to Fahey's piece, mm-hmm. which was called Requiem for John Hurt. And the idea of this back porch quality is this sort of music that's, I think, you know, taking this vernacular concept and imagining just, you know, I think in his program notes he mentions the chirping of cicadas, for example, and just sort of sitting on a back porch listening to great guitar music.
Thank you. Requiem for John Fahey, as played by our guest during University of the Year today, Nicholas Phillips. A lot of different techniques went into that, didn't they?
Yeah.
And I do hear what you say about the structure, because certain themes return. They're very distinctive themes,
right,
too.
Right.
And the passages where it's sounding like the guitar plucking. Mm-hmm. It sounded very difficult to play.
Yeah, it's not an easy piece.
I kept feeling, I know this is silly, but it sounded like you needed to take a breath, you know, because it just keeps going that way. I was wondering, when you got these commissioned new works in the mail, what it felt like. I heard from a member of the Priority Quartet that just when these newly commissioned string quartets arrive in the mail, what a thrill it is when you know you're about to play something that's never been performed before.
Right.
Did you have that experience?
Oh, definitely. You know, and I got to enjoy the process because the composers, you know, I got the pieces at different times over the course of, I think the first piece I got was around December of last year, and then the most recent came in June, and I did the recording in August. So they came in, you know, sort of at different rates, and it is just like a kid on Christmas morning. You know, you sort of can't wait to get to the piano and try it out. And I think, you know, one thing that this has informed in my own teaching and playing is that we should approach music of the past this way too, with the same sort of engaged excitement.
Let me ask a question from the dark side. As a person who commissions music, have you ever had the experience, whoa, I'm not so crazy about this one? And if so, then how do you negotiate that with the composer?
I've not had that experience, not with this project. I'm sure that does happen and requires some honest discussion from the performers, and dialogue, really, between the performer and the composer. You know, the composers that I commissioned for this project, while I haven't met all of them personally, I do know their music and was pretty sure that I would get something that I liked. Or I would not have sought them out for the project.
Did you collaborate with them then on interpretation? Is this, you know, traditional when a performer commissions a work from a composer?
Yeah, and I think that in today's, you know, technology age, it's a little bit easier perhaps than it has been in the past. Yeah, so basically what I did with each work was, you know, I'd receive it and I'd read through it, and I would try not to write the composer until I felt I had gotten the piece in my fingers. For example, if we're studying a Liszt etude, we don't just give up on the first day if we can't read it immediately and say, well, Liszt should have rewritten this.
Sometimes he
often did. So I wanted to get to a point where I was technically comfortable with the pieces and felt that I had something to say with them. And then what I would do, if I did have questions, because composers make mistakes too, you know, sometimes there are errors in the score and you know, you want to get those. Make sure you're playing what the composer really intends. And I had more than one composer say, oh, you know, that's my mistake. That should be a G, or, you know, that's an octave too low. But then what I would do is I would record myself and post a little private YouTube clip just for that composer. And that would give the composer time to listen to the piece, you not be put on the spot like some Skype rehearsals are, you know, where they feel like they have to say something, you know, right away, but give them time to reflect on what I've done, and then they would come back to me with feedback.
We're going to look at more from American Vernacular when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Nicholas Phillips, who has commissioned and performed a CD of piano music that he calls American Vernacular, and these various composers on the disc also provide some insight into the influences, the vernacular influences that inspired them to write the piece. There, for the 20th century at least, has been this connection between classical music and, well, just about every other kind of music, but pop music too, has kind of ironically had an influence on classical music of the 20th and 21st centuries. So you have a songwriter I know that has turned up in your program, Billy Joel, for
That's
example.
That's right. I kind of feel like Billy Joel here at the piano with a microphone.
Well, if you feel like singing,
I won't sing, though. I'll spare the listeners.
That's too bad.
Yeah, Joel Puckett, who teaches out at Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore, when he first approached me about what he was thinking about for his piece, he said, "You know, do you like Billy Joel?" And I said, "Well, you know, you have no idea how often I listened to Billy Joel when I was, you know, a young student." And he said, "Well, great. Well, I have an idea for a piece," because he also liked Billy Joel quite a lot when he was young and played this music. He envisioned a piece that was based on sort of Billy Joel-esque piano licks. For example, the piece starts with this, you know, this sort of open harmony thing. And he didn't use any direct quotes from Billy Joel tunes, so you won't hear, you know, you won't hear the piano man emerge, for example.
But that's okay.
But this idea of stylistically, you know, what he gained from playing Billy Joel's pieces. And there are some really, you know, fun marks in the score. Like the very beginning says, instead of saying allegro, for example, as a marking, he says popular, comma, steady. So there's a reference to the scenes from an Italian restaurant, the lyrics to that piece. And so there are some hidden sort of gems within the score. In that way, but yeah,
the audience wouldn't
see that. Yeah, that's right.
Like in jokes.
Mm-hmm. That's right for the pianist.
So, when you play this piece that we're about to hear, how do you play it in a sort of Billy Joel-esque way?
I think the music speaks for itself. Really, I mean, I think that there are Joel Puckett used, you know, certain things like running octaves, like these ideas that he saw in especially Billy Joel's earlier albums, like the sort of rockabilly piano style. And so I take it for what it is and just have fun with it.
Let's hear it. Thank you.
Well, it's a witty piece, isn't he? He does have that little pentatonic high treble riff that he keeps referring back to in case you're forgetting where you're going.
Right.
Would it be difficult to take a song like Piano Man and play it more in that style? What would it sound like?
Yeah, you know, he probably could have used parts of Piano Man in that tune, although, you know, Piano Man's in three, and this piece was in a duple feel, but I don't know. You know, there were some references to a lot of different pieces in Billitude. Falling in the Rain.
Yes, I'm not sure we mentioned the name,
title,
Billitude.
Right.
Yeah, Billitude is the title of that piece by Joel Puckett. And he has some subtle hints to, you know, his old tunes like Stiletto and Falling of the Rain. And as I mentioned, Scenes from Italian Restaurant.
If he had used whole passages from Piano Man or other songs, would there have been a copyright?
Yeah, there certainly would have been. Yeah. I think it would have, you know, probably been a Billy Joel arranged by Joel Puckett. And so I think he did a really great job of capturing the essence of that music, but with his own voice.
Langston Hughes said at one point that it wasn't until jazz came along that America had its own music. Where in the pieces that you commissioned for this American Vernacular Collection do you see the impact of jazz?
We'll see that in a couple of the pieces that not the next one I'm planning to play, but there are some pieces that use blues, that use funk and bebop. David Rakowski's piece, for example. And in the last piece that I'm going to play for you, maybe we can talk about that a little bit more.
So what are you going to play next?
Next is a little song without words by New York City-based composer Mohammed Fairouz. This is Piano Miniature Number 12, which sort of harkens to the old tearjerker ballads of the Tin Pan Alley days. It's a really beautiful, lyrical, slow work. Thankfully, some of the composers did give me a break and write some slower works. So this is by Mohammed Fairouz. Thank you.
Are there intervals in these pieces in American vernacular that are perhaps more unusual in American piano music in general? I mean, it seems to me I'm hearing what you mentioned, I think, earlier, sevenths and ninths, for example, which seem to be popular with contemporary composers.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a—I don't know that there's anything that ties the pieces together necessarily. All of the composers write in a pretty tonal language, as you can hear. Some of them with perhaps more widely spaced harmonies, and some with those sort of crunchy dissonances, like in the Back Porch Requiem piece.
But what made that particularly American, what you just played?
Well, I think that they're not all of the pieces are as clear. Some of them are more abstract. There's a piece, for example, called On the Drawing of Constellations, which is on the disc, which takes more the idea of the triad, you know, being sort of this basic unit of all vernacular music, but taking it in a very abstract way. And so I think that's what makes the album kind of interesting, is that they're not, you know, you asked about jazz earlier. And, you know, I could have very easily gotten back 10, you know, jazzy pieces, or 10 rags, for example. And I really appreciate the variety the variety of directions the composers took, because some of them did take musical idioms or musical traditions. And for example, that miniature, Feruz said it, he was inspired by this sort of Tin Pan Alley days. So that's the vernacular tradition for that piece. Other composers like Ethan Wickman, his piece uses the landscape of the American West as a starting point. And I think that what it means to be American is a very, very open and broad question, and to apply that to music, it's really great to see how the composers did that.
You think it's getting a little harder to define Americanness in music now that globally things wash back and forth so quickly?
Sure. I mean, I think it is. I think it's up to the composer, you know, to reflect that meaning. And one of the pieces, is an homage to Alberto Ginastera. So South American,
yes.
So you know, and Mark Olivieri's piece, you know, dips into some South American, you know, rhythms and musical figures and concepts with the tango and so forth. You know, the idea of the project wasn't to define what is American. That wasn't my intent, but rather to give that theme to the composers and let them take it in the direction they felt best represented the theme.
The theme seems to have led to a lot of variety.
Yeah, that's right.
Two more samples coming up when we return with University of the Air. That's from the piece Occidental Psalmody, one of the selections on a disc called American Vernacular by our guest on University of the Air, Nicholas Phillips. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. I'm struck by some of the amazing titles of these works that you've commissioned. They themselves seem to illustrate American vernacular, including Hot Fingers, where it's a group of three different works, but it includes what? Super Fractalistic and, you know, Growing
Season Blues.
Yes.
Yeah, and the subtitle is Three Vernacular Non-Dances.
So tell us about that, Hot Fingers.
Yeah, so that has, I think, an interesting backstory, but this is a piece by David Rakowski, and Rakowski is really well known to pianists that are aware of music that's being written for our instrument today. He just finished 100 piano etudes recently and has moved on to writing preludes. And his music is full of vernacular qualities, especially musical idioms. And so Hot Fingers is a set of three dances which are loosely sort of a funk in the first, a blues in the second, and then a sort of bebop in the third. And they're great fun to play.
Can you give us a sample?
Yeah, so so for example, in the second movement in the Growing Season Blues, there's a section written poco a poco più ubriaco, or little by little more drunken. And so forth. And so in that one, the blues elements are really pretty clear. In the first one, in Super Fractalistic, you know, the pianist is told, you know, at one point just to rock out hard. And so forth. So, you know, the language of this piece, I think, you know, shows these bebop, funk, and blues characteristics really well. And the piece that I'm going to play for you is the third, with the subtitle is Écoutez et répétez, or Listen and Repeat.
Well, you know, I have to admit these all look difficult to me in terms of the technique required. But are there particular tricks in here that really pushed your envelope, Nick?
You know, they're all hard. They're all technically hard, but I think with this type of music, you have to approach it the same way you approach, you know, the quote classics. And that is, you know, you sit down and you work out fingerings and you work out passages and you get it to where it feels good. It's hard music, but it's worth, you know, it's worth the effort, I think, because it's such wonderful stuff.
So you end up with hat fingers like the title?
Yeah, that's right. One critic reviewed that piece and he said that he thought it was sort of like the equivalent to like a modern day finale to Prokofiev's Seventh Sonata, which is one of these barn burner works. And you know, there were a few composers that wrote slower works, and I think that when I got those, I always immediately thanked them.
I would gather you would space those in appropriately
in a recital program. Yeah.
And what made you select Stakes Is Higher as the last thing we're going to hear? What about that?
Well, I think that piece shows a much less abstract approach to the theme of the album. I've worked with Marc Olivieri before and I've played some of his music, and so I was really thrilled that he wrote this piece for me. And it continues, the set, Spectacular Vernaculars, continues his theme of writing sort of homage pieces. The first movement, for example, is an homage to Alberto Ginastera, and the second is an homage to Billie Holiday. So,
wow, that's a combination.
Yeah, two musical figures that were very influential in his early training. And then the third, I think, has just kind of a great story. It's Marc is himself a very fine pianist and a great improviser and jazz pianist. And he chose two musical figures for this piece. It's called Stakes Is Higher, an homage to Ahmad Jamal, who's a jazz pianist, and De La Soul, who was a hip-hop group, sort of popular in the 90s. Well, De La Soul had a piece called Stakes Is High. And they used this theme from Ahmad Jamal had a tune called Swahili Land. And he uses this chord progression. And so De La Soul used that as a loop, and then they would rap over it. And so it's really kind of an interesting combination of those two elements. And so then Marc uses that chordal section in this piece, and he calls it Stakes Is Higher.
Let's hear it.
Thank you.
stakes is higher. Question about venues for this kind of music. We're not exactly calling it classical music, although it has form and it certainly refers to earlier forms of American music. Is this the kind of thing that you would do as some classical performers are doing now and take it to clubs, for example?
That's an interesting question. I do consider it classical music, and I perform it as such. The tour that I've done, which really started in the fall, has included some traditional places like university settings. Some of the composers are on faculty at various places, and I've gone and played there, and I played this in Eau Claire as my faculty recital this year, for example. But what I've really enjoyed is taking it to alternative venues. I've played it in a small piano hall in New York City. I played it at a kind of, like you mentioned, a club in Chicago where patrons can grab a drink and then come sit down and listen. It's really a concert setting. I mean, it's very respectful and people sit and a lot of new music occurs there. It's called Constellation. And just a few weeks ago, I played it in an art museum in Missoula, Montana, for example. And I really like getting out of the university setting to play in those alternate venues because the audience is just really engaged. It's great.
Do you have plans for an American Vernacular Part 2?
Not at the moment.
Or another project like it?
I love themed projects, and so I'm always thinking, but I don't have anything at the moment. This has been this is my third CD, but the first devoted to a group of composers. And the first CD I did was actually all works by Ethan Wickman, who's on this disc as well, a former colleague of mine in Eau Claire. And the second was a CD of music by a Croatian composer, Boris Papandopoulos. So I've done these sort of single composer albums, and this has been my first multi-composer, and it was a lot of fun, and I don't rule out doing something similar in the future.
What about compositions of your own? It seems to me you're not too far away from that. I mean, if you do just even a little bit of improv, this almost invites it seems to me.
Yeah, you know, people ask me that question if I'm a composer, and I'm not. Maybe in another lifetime, but I'm not much of an improviser either, which is why I really enjoy Mark's pieces because it makes me feel like I'm a jazz pianist. It's all written out, though.
Yeah, that's kind of the fascinating discrepancy there because it does have a very improvised quality to it. I mean, we're watching you reading music, but it still comes across as being, well, as you say, very much in your fingers.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I've never, there was once as an undergraduate that I played in a jazz combo, not very well. but that's not a skill that's ever been, really strong in me. It's something I like to explore.
So in that sense, you are a classical musician because you deal with a score always.
Oh, I'm very much a classical musician. I mean, I play a fair amount of new music, but generally it's in the context of a traditional program. So for example, Beethoven Sonata, Mendelssohn Variations, and then a piece by a new composer, and then a Prokofiev Sonata. I mean, that's pretty typical. This particular program is, I think it's great because, audiences can't avoid the new music section on the program because it's all new.
It's all new. you can't just get through it so you can get back to Beethoven.
They can't just, leave at intermission because they see something unknown on the second half. But what's been really fun is talking with people after recitals, whether it's in a university or at the museum or whatnot. And people always have a different favorite for a different reason, So I think that speaks to the variety of the pieces and how there's really something for everyone.
And thank you for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Nicholas Phillips, and his disc is called American Vernacular. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.